At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Consider this as we get going today, because it's perhaps the fundamental truth in the global economy right now. You can prop up bad debt till the cows come home, bail it out, rescue it, do what you will to it. But until somebody takes the loss, it's still bad debt. And that is a very bad thing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday today. This one's the 18th of August. Good as always to have you with us. And yeah, you're right. We have seen this movie before. Traders all over the world took a look around today, didn't like what they saw, and started selling. It was, if you'll pardon the expression, a day for four-letter words in the markets, most of which, save one, aren't really suitable for this radio program. I'm thinking here of debt. The giant pool of bad loans out there still weighing everything down. As it happens, that's the theme for today on The Breakdown, our economy one step at a time. Debt and the price we're paying for it. First, though, the day on Wall Street, I don't know exactly how it's going to go when we get there. I never really do. But it's a safe bet that when we do the numbers, you're going to hear me say something like this. Financials led the way down today, and then a grim recitation of individual bank share price drops. Because it seems like every time the markets get hammered of late, banks get it worst. We've called our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore, to ask her how come. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
So help me out here. Why is it that the banks are among the first to get hit when the markets go bad?
Well, it's the same reason that banks are the first to get robbed, because that's where the money is. So basically what we saw after the financial crisis is that we have a tremendous distrust of major institutions, banks, European governance. You're seeing revolutions over half the world. And that's partially because of this huge financial angle. We know now that banks are inextricably linked with our political systems. And our political systems are obviously having a bit of trouble right now, right? So I talked to Bill Isaac. He's a former chairman of the FDIC, which is the big bank regulator. Mm-hmm. Right now, he's at FTI Consulting. And I asked him, is there any reason that we keep hitting the banks?
How can you feel comfortable investing when the government's got $1.5 trillion of adding to the debt every year? When state and local governments are in disarray and Europe's in disarray, how could you feel that we had our troubles behind us? I think we're recognizing that we still have a lot of work to do.
And so that's where we are right now. A lot of the debt in our system, the things that we're trying to pay off, are not, it's not new debt. It is debt from 2000 to 2007 that is still working its way through our banks, through our homes, through our credit cards. And until we pay that off, we can't start fresh.
Say that again. This is a very important point. All the toxic assets that we grew so familiar with in 2007 and 2008, they're still out there.
They are still out there. And in fact, a good number of them are now housed at the Federal Reserve. So you should feel very comfortable about that. The Fed bought a lot of those assets from the banks, but the banks still do have some. Now, that said, those aren't killer assets anymore in the way that they used to be. The banks are stronger. They've hoarded more money, which has worked to their benefit. And in fact, the banks are doing better than the economy. But nonetheless, what we know is that banks depend on funding day to day. And that is always what's going to hurt them in a panic. Because in a panic, what happens is the short-term worries start to have people pull back credit lines, you know, wonder, do I have enough money on hand? And if a bank wants to survive on that short-term funding, it's going to suffer because those credit lines are totally built on psychological confidence. And that's the first thing to go when there's a market tremor.
Well, back up for a second here and let's talk about the health of the banks. You and I have said before on this broadcast, people have done stories about how the banks are making so much money. Are we now to understand that they're not healthy enough given the uncertainty?
How could they be, really, right? I mean, to some extent, they are exposed to the economy, and our economy is not doing well, right? So insofar as you have consumers with problems, you're going to have banks with problems because that's where consumers get their money. So you have foreclosures. That's still weighing on the banks. We have a huge period of low growth coming. Low interest rates are hurting the banks, too, because they can't make money anymore with interest rates that are this low. So if you look at the future, bank earnings aren't going to be so good. And that is also worrying people and maybe why the banks get hit when you see something like this.
Our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore, on the banks, the health thereof, and how they're connected to what's going on today. Heidi, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Bad as it was at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today, which was plenty bad, believe you me. At least Wall Street ended with major indices climbing, trying to get out of their deep hole. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'm not sure I really need to say this given the synchronicity that global exchanges have been exhibiting of late, but European stocks fell sharply today. The main indices in London, Paris, and Frankfurt all gave up 5% or more. European bank shares, just to echo what Heidi was saying, dropped 10%. Traders were clearly worried about the bank's exposure to the most heavily indebted countries in the eurozone. You know who they are. And also about the prospects that European leaders might not actually be able to solve the long-running debt crisis over there. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
This week, the leaders of Germany and France unveiled a grand plan to solve the debt crisis. They called it an economic government for Europe. The idea, to have the 17 eurozone countries coordinate their economies and their public spending. So, is it going to work? Steve Barrow of Standard Bank.
No, it's a very long way from solving the debt crisis. We've heard all this sort of thing before from eurozone leaders.
The markets want hard cash, not grand plans. They fear that Spain and Italy may not be able to pay their debts. Investors want to see the stability facility or bailout fund beefed up. Marcel Alexandrovich is with Jefferies International Bank.
They have to shore up, I think, the markets in the near term, and that probably means expanding the size of the stability mechanism to support countries that need it across Europe.
But the Germans, who must stump up most of the cash, are suffering from bailout fatigue. They're refusing to cough up any further. And, says Steve Barrow, they're not keen on the other main solution either, a unified eurobond for all eurozone governments with the same rate of interest for all backed by the whole of the eurozone.
Germany is concerned that why should other countries that have not been as tough on the budget as Germany, like Greece and Ireland, for instance, why should those countries pay the same interest rate as Germany?
Financial logic suggests that some eurozone governments may, in the end, default and some banks go bust, but the eurozone is in denial. The search goes on for a less painful solution. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Debt's a phenomenon in the global economy right now in a lot of people's minds. So we went to London this morning and asked this question. Debt, good, bad, or both?
You need to have debt, you need to have leverage, and you need to have credit. Without that, if we're just on a cash-based society, then companies can't grow, people can't get education. I mean, most of daily activity is based on some kind of debt.
When people are in debt for a period of time and you see they can't pay the debt, it should be wiped off, like we wipe the bankers off, then you get a chance to start again.
I mean, it's pretty overwhelming, the amount of debt that we're under. And for me, I feel personally that I'm probably in an okay place, but I know that's not necessarily the case with the general public.
John Byrne, Kieran Kozelbosch, and Nora Nona in London today. And then this from the colonies.
I think it's kind of scary, but I don't think we're as bad off as other countries, though, either.
I think debt is basically a financial tool that you can use to leverage your situation.
You have people who have never had any debt who can't get credit, so I don't necessarily think debt is a bad thing.
Debt is the devil. I mean, literally.
It's a necessary evil. It has to exist. It's what this country kind of runs on.
Joanne Blocker and Don Cropper in Los Angeles, Joy Hamilton-Jones and Todd Hayes in Nashville, Maria De La Vega in Atlanta. There is, of course, good debt and bad debt in any given economy. Buying a house or paying for college? Generally good. Borrowing to buy three new flat screens for that house? Generally bad. This is, as it happens, an exceptionally good time for good debt. The Fed says it's going to keep short-term interest rates pretty close to zero for at least two more years. But just as there's good debt and bad debt, there are two sides to those low interest rates as well. From Washington Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
In a nutshell, this is what the Federal Reserve said to savers last week. You're not going to make any money on your savings until halfway through 2013, at the earliest. Interest rates on savings accounts, on certificates of deposit or CDs are really, really low. And the Fed says they're going to stay that way.
The low interest rates on CDs, it's criminal. It is really criminal that you can put $10,000 in a CD and maybe get 1.5% if you're very lucky.
That's Dana Meyer. She's been retired for about 2 years now. She and her husband live in Omaha.
We started several years ago socking money away in CDs when the interest rates were at 5%. And every time one of these comes due, you know, the interest rate goes down, down, down. And it's heartbreaking.
The rate on a 12-month CD is around 0.125%. So if you put $10,000 into a CD, a year later, you'd be $80 richer. Back when Meyer was putting money into CDs, when the interest rate was 5%, the income on that same $10,000 would have been $500. When you think of the billions of dollars people have in savings, that's kind of extraordinary. Alicia Minnell directs the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. She says low rates are bad for savers of all stripes, but especially for retirees.
In terms of people who are trying to live off the income from their assets, it's a real negative event.
Minnell says high rates in the 80s and 90s gave folks a false sense of security. In 1981, you could lock in a CD backed by the government at 15 or 16%. Now, that's the historical high, but there were folks who didn't think rates would drop. They thought they'd continue to make a lot of money, and they could finance their retirement with Social Security plus interest from their savings.
The idea of just having a pile and having an income rolling in from that pile is no longer feasible.
For many retirees, low interest rates have eroded that pile. Dana Meyer and her husband have seen that happen.
We've had to dip into our CDs to do things like pay for a new furnace, pay for repairs to the house.
She says they never had big plans for retirement, no trips around the world or anything like that. But they've had to cut back on expenses more than they expected. Economists I talked to said savers can get desperate when interest rates drop, especially as they get close to retirement. Jim Chesson is the chief economist at the American Bankers Association.
What I worry about is that there are some people that are saying, I need to take more risks. I need to invest in the market. And that may be a strategy that works, but it can be a strategy that doesn't and has very bad consequences.
Today we got new data from the Labor Department, the Consumer Price Index for the month of July. And we learned inflation is on the rise. And that, coupled with low interest rates, means folks will effectively lose money on whatever they have in the bank. So why keep it there? Because it's secure. It's federally guaranteed. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Thank you. Coming up, watching the Fed nervously.
Everyone's now worried about what the inflation outbreak will mean for them.
But first, let's do the numbers. So you knew it was going to be the wah-wah trombones, right? The Dow Industrials plowed down 3.2% today, 419 points on the blue chips, closed at 10,990. The NASDAQ crashed 5.2% lower, 131 points, ended at 2380. The S&P 500 drained nearly 4.5%. That's 53 points, finished at 1140. Here you go. Financials led the way down as promised. Morgan Stanley slid nearly 4.75% after it lowered its growth forecast. Citigroup crumbled 6%. Bank of America barreled down 6% as well. Hewlett-Packard unplugged nearly 6% today on news it's going to spin off its PC business, that'd be Compact, and spend a bunch of money on a British software firm. Bond prices, oh, they were buying. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped to 2% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The United Nations recognizes the dedication of aid workers with World Humanitarian Day. Vice President Biden is in the midst of a 9-day official visit to Asia, and it's billed as the ultimate Disney fan event. The D23 Expo gets underway in Anaheim. Attendees can enter dressed as their favorite character. I see princesses. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. TransUnion said this week the credit card delinquency rate in this country hit a 17-year low, mainly because people are just using their credit cards less and their debit cards more. Which brings us to today's news. Wells Fargo is going to start testing a $3 monthly fee for people who want to use their debit cards. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins explains how using their own money is getting more and more costly for consumers.
These days, it seems like we go on a spending spree just to use our money. ATM fees, fees for having too small a balance, fees for checks.
You've seen the virtual elimination of free checking.
That's Jason Corstange. He works for TCF Bank. Corstange says in October, federal regulations will limit the amount merchants pay to take debit cards.
So that difference is going to have to be made up.
That same month, Wells Fargo will charge debit card users a monthly fee in 5 states. J.P. Morgan Chase, Regions Financial, and SunTrust are considering similar moves. Banks introduced debit cards as an alternative to labor-intensive check processing.
Debit cards became the choice of banks because it was such an enormous cost savings.
Robert Manning is the author of Credit Card Nation. He says banks pass those savings on to consumers.
Charging people for debit cards when you're basically spending your own money is basically inflating the cost of all the high technology efficiencies that have been invested.
Ali Raza is with Spear & Associates. He says if he were a Wells Fargo customer, this is what he'd do.
I limit my debit card usage at the point of sale and I start paying with a credit card.
And those new limits on swipe fees don't apply to credit cards.
If I'm a large credit card issuer, why not incent my customers to use a credit card instead of a debit card?
Which Raza said could end up inflating consumer debt. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
This was a big week for the Midwest, the Iowa straw poll last weekend. Also, President Obama and his bus tour the past 3 days. The presidential motorcade rolled south along Highway 52 toward the town of Decorah at one point. It was one of Mr. Obama's stops during his trip. It's a route that Don Holshue knows well. He's been driving trucks all over the Midwest for decades. Now, Mr. Holshue, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Let me ask you where we tracked you down, first of all. You're out on the road today?
I'm on the road. I'm in northeast Iowa by a small town of Orrin, Iowa. I just delivered to a family hardware store.
Tell me about these family hardware stores you delivered to. What do they tell you when you walk in the door with a new box of pliers or something? How's business been?
Most of them are saying it's okay. It's squishy. You know, it's not not gangbusters, and it's you know, they're holding their own. That's about it.
The recent craziness in the stock market and people worrying again about the economy, is that sort of trickling down to Iowa?
Well, everybody's worried about the economy. The biggest complaint that I hear is the price of everything. It's just killing everybody.
Like gas and food and all that. I mean, you know, we saw the inflation numbers today, right?
Oh, it's everything. It's not even gas and food. It's basic material. The first time in my life that I'm cutting back, and it doesn't make any difference. It's frustrating where everything has gone up and seems to go up all the time. And I have a budget. And beforehand, 3 years ago, I was able to make it no problem. But now I'm one nostril above the water. And when a wave comes by, it puts me under.
How long have you been driving this truck route, Mr. Holcher?
I've been driving semi-trucks for 34 years.
Mind if I ask you how much you make every year doing this?
This job, I make about $50,000 to $52,000.
And when you're not on the road, you have your own home, you have a 401k. I mean, you live a regular financial life, right?
Right. I just a regular American life, you know, supposed American life.
Well, yeah. So one of the reasons why we called you is to get a sense of the regular consumer, because there's all this pressure, as you know. I mean, the analysts and everybody says, you know, consumers have to spend more to get this economy back in gear. Question is, are you in a position to do that?
No, I don't have any extra money. In fact, I'm trying to save money. And when I look at products, when I go to a store, I've gotten to the point where I don't buy anything from China. Unless I really have to buy it, I'll buy it. But I'm not a, you know, just go out just to buy for buying's sake. That's not how we're going to get out of this recession.
You talk about the recession as if it's present tense, but technically the recession's over, right? It's been over for 2 years.
Oh, I don't know what book you've been reading. It hasn't. And I travel, I talk to like the small areas, and it's like, it hasn't. You know, it may be in some university or college, but it's not on the ground.
Donald Holshue has been driving trucks in the Midwest part of this country for about 35 years. Mr. Holshue, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much.
Drive safe out there.
Okay, no problem. Use your turn signals.
We just had, about as directly as you can get, the voice of the American consumer, Don Holshue, and his worries about the economy and the high price of everything, as he said. Now to somebody who, until last year, directly affected those prices by helping to set interest rates. Thomas Honig is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. In 2010, he was a member of the Federal Open Market Committee. That is the office of the Federal Reserve that controls what's called monetary policy or interest rates. Mr. Honig, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here with you.
When you were on the Federal Open Market Committee last year, you dissented from every single one of the statements that
Correct.
The Board of Governors made, in which they Correct. Said, we're going to keep rates as low as we can for as long as we can.
Correct.
Why? What's your contrarian position?
Well, the interview you just had is why. This individual who's working hard to make ends meet, seeing all his prices go up, his input costs, and that's the reflection of having very easy monetary policy for an extended period of time. He can't make ends meet, and what's fair about that?
Had you had your way last year and been able to convince the board at the FOMC to raise mm-hmm. interest rates, mm-hmm. what would be happening in the economy right now? I mean, how would that have played out?
No one knows. It's a counterfactual. But what I'm saying is that I was not in favor of high interest rates. There's a difference.
Yep, yep.
I was in favor of taking it off zero because zero is misallocating credit. Who wants to save at zero? What you do is you encourage further leverage in a country that is already highly leveraged.
More borrowing.
Yes. And I ask the question, can you name me a product, can you name me a service that trades well, that allocates resources well at a price of zero? And the answer has uniformly been no. So why would you expect credit to be different?
Right.
All I was saying is a modest increase so we begin to let the markets decide where resources ought to be allocated. And in doing that, take away the uncertainty about the future in the sense of everyone's now worried about what the inflation outbreak will mean for them, just like this truck driver.
Has not the Fed, though, taken away the uncertainty for the future? They said the other day, we're going to keep rates low till 2013. You guys are secure in that.
My own view is that they've actually increased the uncertainty because what does that mean? You mean to tell me that we have to stay at zero for another 2 years? Is the economy that bad? People are asking that question. And then they're saying with that, well, what does it mean for inflation? And that's why you see the price of gold, I think, moving up very rapidly, commodities who've paused now, I think, I fear, will rise depending on how the economy itself does. So what I fear, I hope I'm wrong, but what I fear is that we've increased uncertainty, not removed it.
What should the role of consumers be in this economy?
The consumer is the citizen, and they have to buy goods and services, and they want to be able to do it in an environment where prices are stable. But I don't think the consumer can bail out all issues, because here's one of the things that's happened in this country. The consumer used to amount to about two-thirds, 66% of our gross domestic product. And as we moved through the boom, it moved all the way to 70%. So we were relying on the consumer for much more of our growth in the economy. We were not saving as much. And to do that, we were borrowing from the rest of the world, so it increased our debt to the rest of the world. Then what are you doing? You're consuming more than you're producing. And what we need to be thinking about in this country is how do we reemphasize production enough to meet reasonably our needs, enough to export to the rest of the world so that we're now balanced, that we're consuming and producing in a line with one another. It's not easy to get there. It took us two decades to get where we are today. But to have that in mind so that we are a balanced economy and an industrial and consuming leader of the world as we once were.
You turn 65 next month. You have to retire because Fed rules say you have to retire at 65. What are you going to do with yourself if you don't get to dabble in monetary policy anymore?
Well, I have to retire from the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, but I don't necessarily have to retire.
Fair enough. Thomas Honig is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Mr. Honig, thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome. Good to be with you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, Ron Paul made a funny about the Republican presidential field today. Remember the other day we noted Texas Governor Rick Perry's displeasure with what the Federal Reserve's doing about interest rates? He said printing more money between now and Election Day for political purposes would be treasonous. Well, fellow GOP hopeful Ron Paul, the guy who wants us back on the gold standard and whose book is called End the Fed, Paul said today that Perry's remarks make him look like a moderate. I thought that was pretty funny. All right, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. We got to go. Today, the Dow dropped 3.2%, 419 points. The NASDAQ surrendered 5.2%, 131 points. The S&P 500 forfeited nearly 4.5%. That is 53 points. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. The next installment of The Breakdown, Our Economy One Step at a Time, comes to you tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report. And then next time, back here.
It's kind of embarrassing, though, because, you know, the United States has basically had a prime credit rating throughout just about all of our history.
Ah, the good old days. But now what? I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.